How about a little extra?
Hardcore history.
One of the themes that has dominated this hardcore history podcast we do since the very first episode has been the question of how, you know, the distance between the now and whatever we're talking about in the past influences how you see things. In the very first show we ever did, the 15-minute epic we call Alexander versus Hitler, we talked about how, you know, we see Alexander the Great one way, looking back on it thousands of years from his life, and Hitler another way because it's a generation ago, and asked the heretical question, how much of a difference will an extreme amount of time make when people 1,000 or 1,500 years from now look back on Adolf Hitler? Is it going to be the way we see him now, or is it going to be different? And we pegged this whole idea on the fact that, you know, some historians out there work very hard to rid us of the romantic notions of Alexander the Great and point out what a butcher he was and all these terrible things that get lost in the hype and the mystique and all that stuff. Even in Athens, there probably isn't a single person who's still emotional and upset about, you know, Alexander and his father kicking the Athenians' rear end at the Battle of Chaeronea. Probably not that upset about it anymore. That's the point. That's the point where history begins to be writable, I guess you could say, if you were involved in what's known as historiography. The process of writing and doing history. Doing is a good word because historiographers do all this kind of stuff, which is, it's constructing and reconstructing history sometimes, I mean, which needs to be done. The point is that one of the basic ideas that those people struggle with when they're doing their work is the question of distance. Distance is required, it has always been said, when you're studying history. You want a number of decades to pass after events are through to let things like the emotion that colors the views of the time to leach out of the story so you could become a more dispassionate observer, so you're not caught up in the hype and the, you know, the visceral feelings of the age. As I said, if the Athenians today still felt as emotional about that loss of Chaeronea and losing their freedom to the Macedonians, they wouldn't be writing very unbiased histories about the subject, would they, right? But the emotion has leached out of that story. Hasn't leached out of the story we dealt with in the recent hardcore history program. A lot of people thought that was a World War II story. I had intended it to be almost an abbreviated version of the history of strategic bombing. Regardless of what I wanted it to be, it provoked some strong reactions amongst a few people who would have preferred more of a focus on good and evil, I think. I think good and evil is always implied in that story. I think one of the things we were trying to get into was the dynamic and the way that people get swept up into this process. And then once they're in it, they have such a narrow range of choices. It's almost like you're on the Autopia cars at Disneyland. I don't know if you've ever been on those, but they have a track running through the middle. But you're in a car and you can drive and steer and you can go 10 or 20 degrees to the right, 10, 20 degrees to the left, and you feel like you're driving. But if you go too far in any one direction, you know, that rail in the middle that the car rides on stops you. I'm fascinated with people who get swept up into the gears of history and find themselves unable to, you know, deal with their little teeny range of choices and see how they just become a part of the narrative in ways that maybe they're just dragged into it sometimes. I have a lot of sympathy for the plight historical characters often find themselves in. I think sometimes that's what works in the program, right? We try to give a first-person perspective because that's what I'm thinking of sometimes. Whatever it is, the people on the ground being bombed when we're talking about this story of strategic bombing, or the people in the planes having to endure what they're enduring in order to do the job. We'll talk more about that in a minute. These extra hardcore history editions that we're doing, the attempt is to try to simply talk off the cuff. If somebody was interviewing me about this, we might jump around a lot, but hopefully we get a lot of worthwhile information and extra stuff out, and that's the way I'm looking at this. So if it sounds disorganized and like we didn't plan very much, that's by design or lack thereof. In any case, the way I'm working this is I have a bunch of notes left over from the last show that I just never got to, and I'd like to get to them now. I'd like to point out, and I think I'd like to make this a regular part of these extra hardcore history segments, sort of a director's cut look at how this whole show evolved the way it did. I do know we have a lot of podcasters in the audience, and they like this stuff. Hopefully you do too. So we'll start by just saying that once again, we had no intention of doing this show when we first sat down and said, okay, what's the next hardcore history show we're going to do? This was not even on the radar. And this is part, you know, the audience doesn't know, and I don't blame them, why it takes so long for us to get these programs out. But it feels like, you know, pre-World War I Europe and all the nations of the world that are going to fight this war are on a strict mobilization schedule. And everybody's freaked out that if anything goes wrong, they'll set themselves 2 days behind and they'll never catch up. That's how the Hardcore History Show happens. We get one out, we're all fried, and I all of a sudden realize, uh-oh, I need the next topic. I need to be working on the next topic, right? And generally, it rushes me into making a choice I shouldn't make, and we always have to play catch-up. In this case, I'd read an article on something that I thought you all would have liked a lot. It was a different subject. It was weird and strange, and I ordered books. There was nothing written on it, just this one article, but there were books that I could get and maybe divine information from and build a show out of pieces of other people's work. So I order all these books. I start doing the reading and slog through this stuff for like 3 weeks, with a growing understanding that the article that I'd read that got me so hyped to do this story was wrong, was straight up wrong, unsupportable. I had basically disproved the, you know, story that I was basing this whole hardcore history show on. I had, well, in news we used to call it another good story killed by overchecking. Well, I had overchecked the hardcore history show into non-existence, and my mobilization schedule was 3 weeks and like 3 days down the road. We panicked. What do we do? Well, we resorted to the unthinkable on this program and went back and just looked at what people were asking us to do. We don't really take requests around here, but if I had to name the number one subject people ask us to talk about, it's the morality of dropping the atomic bombs. Now, we told you the reality in the last program about this subject, and I've talked about it in the political and current events show we do a couple of times, but I hate the subject because of the context problem. That's not one of those issues that makes sense if you just examine it. You know, okay, it's summer 1945. Shouldn't they have dropped the atomic bomb? You have to understand what the people who had to make these decisions and everything, you know, what had led up to it. Otherwise, it makes no sense, right? It's like tuning into the soap opera in the middle of the story and going, now, who's that person and why are they mad at that? You just don't know. You have to have some context. And that's how we got into the whole idea of strategic bombing. So now I have to do the reading for this new subject, which is something I already knew something about, which is how I always kind of work. But, you know, order the books. The books arrive. I start reading. We're like 5 weeks into this thing, and I'm still doing research, jotting down ideas, getting ideas. Then we start recording, and the thing just, I mean, one of our test takes was like 4 hours long, and I'm not even to the Second World War yet. This happens, by the way. People say, how do they get so long? I don't know, but they do. We threw it out. And I thought it was good. I thought it was a little dry, a little narrative, but there was a lot of good stuff in there, and I have some of it in my hot little hand still that I'm going to throw at you now anyway. But you do essentially a four-hour show and then throw it out and start over, that's going to mess with your mobilization schedule too. So I think people wonder, what are we doing this whole time? Oh my gosh, you wouldn't believe it. Freaking out from start to finish. So the A-bomb idea became an easy way to recover from yet another mistake on my part, picking topics. Once you pick it too, you're on that utopia rail. You're stuck. And to jump off of it like we did 3 weeks into the process here is almost unthinkable. And to choose a topic like this was, as you might imagine, somewhat dicey due to the question of it's still immediacy. It's still very close and the emotions still run very hot. And what's interesting is how I want them to run hot in one respect. I mean, you quake a little bit when you think about people 1,000 years from now trying to think about the Nazi Hitler Holocaust story with the emotion bled out of it. In one sense, you'll get your dispassionate observation, but you're going to lose a lot of the evil when you do. I'll give you an example. You know, we talked about the Battle of Chaeronea a minute ago. You go look at these horrible things that these Assyrian soldiers are doing on these carved reliefs in the Middle East from, you know, 750 BCE to the Elamite people. Or what the Babylonians were doing in some of their conquest where they would, you know, kill 20,000 people after the battle by hand. Or my goodness, look at the Mongols, right? the incredible atrocities they did. The Mongols are in the process, by the way, folks, of being rehabilitated. You hear, I mean, I always think back to, okay, if you're one of the people who lived in Baghdad when the Mongols swept through there and did all their damage, and you found out in the future people were going to say, oh, listen, the great Khan, he was facilitating trade, and he was actually quite tolerant in all this. Well, that all might be true, but to someone who lived through the emotion of the time, I imagine their jaw is just going to drop, right? If 2,000 years from now somebody's going, well, of course, Adolf Hitler was involved in atrocities. He also did this, though, and this other positive thing. And you're just going to, you know, people from our times are just going to go, are you out of your mind? That's why you have to have an A.B. Bosworth reminding you that Alexander the Great is not some philosopher king that we all admire and go, God, wasn't he like a Mozart of the battlefield? You know, no, he was a butcher who killed women and children and did it for sport and did it for glory. And remember that. Can't write history until a certain period has gone. Problem is, you lose important things over that time distance. The point of telling you that, though, is we might not have lost enough before telling this story. Got a few people mad at me because sounded a little too pro-Axis, maybe. A little bit too much sympathy with the bad guys in the story. Well, I apologize for that. I look at a lot of people as being just regular people. I don't believe most people are responsible for things like the grand events of history. If you tell me that the Germans invade Belgium in the First World War, blah, 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 I'm sorry, I'm not going to tell you that most average Germans are responsible for that. I don't think they play a huge role, nor do I think they care. I think they're just trying to live their lives. I think the people in every country of the world, the vast majority of them, just want to, you know, they want to take care of their family, they want to stay out of trouble, they want to live their life, they want to succeed and be, you know, they're thinking about normal human emotions and motivations. How many Germans really thought to themselves in 1938, listen, we need to take down France and we could take down Britain, and I hope the government does that. I guess what I'm saying, folks, is to me, all of us have the potential to get caught up in the gears of history, and I have a lot of sympathy for people when it happened. When you talk about something like bombing human beings, and I said it was a war crime, people got upset with that. People thought I was saying that our soldiers were war criminals. No, I was saying that what looks to be absolutely insane to our modern eyes seemed sane and logical to a lot of people in the time period. That's part of a dynamic. That's something we could fall into ourselves. That's why I said, you know, if I gave you an atomic bomb and made the decision yours, would you drop it on Berlin the first day of the war and stop the whole war? That's to show you the kind of questions that people had to face, and to show you that you yourself could easily find your very narrow band of options, actually making the idea of killing a million people, including women and children, the right move. That's an appalling sort of dynamic as a human being to find yourself trapped in, don't you think? I think so many of the people in this story find themselves trapped in that dynamic, and they're just trying to do the best job they can. You know, we didn't have much time to talk about the plight of the people who were doing the bombing in the last show. We did in the very long version, the four-hour piece that I threw out, had that all woven into it, ended up on the cutting room floor, and then we thought, well, that's what these extra hardcore histories are for. We'll throw it in there. These guys would go up in these planes, you know, to drop bombs on the enemy, and especially the Bomber Command and the American pilots of the American Air Corps, the American Army Air Corps, and they would, I mean, the mortality rate, first of all, was incredible on these things. And the way that they had set the number of missions before you were allowed to stop was perverse. I mean, it was something like, you know, only 5%, some ridiculous number, were going to survive 20 missions or something. So they say, okay, well, you can be out of the bomber business once you've gone through 22 missions. I mean, it was not a suicide job, but it was a darn near suicide job. And the kids, and I say kids because if you walked on, you know, your flight, you're going to Hawaii and you get to the plane, and as you're walking on board, you get to see your pilot, and your pilot looks like they're 22. And their co-pilot there, you feel better that they've got a co-pilot. The co-pilot looks younger than that. You're going to be freaking out. Maybe you're okay with that. Maybe you've got a really responsible son and you can see him flying the plane. No problem. And you sit back in your seat and now you hit some turbulence. And it's rough turbulence. Your stomach going to jump a little bit. I know I've been freaked out on planes before where we'll be in thunderstorms and hitting turbulence. And there's a weird sort of fear. You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of the fear you get. There's a ride at one of these amusement parks that was where I grew up, was close by. And basically, it's just you go way up high on, you know, like an elevator takes you way up high. And then this device simply free falls you, just drops you. And it stops you before, you know, slows you down and everything before you hit the ground, obviously. I'm still here. But it gives you that feeling of a fall for a bit. And it's sort of the same feeling you get in the airplane during the thunderstorm when the turbulence is bad and you're thinking any second, can the wings handle this sort of strain? And boom, the free fall and the pit of your stomach. That is the very least that these people, these kids in a lot of cases who are flying these bomber missions, have to deal with. You have to imagine all that stuff. And now you have to imagine, first of all, that most of these, until the very end of the war, these bombers aren't heated. They're freezing. I mean, like, minus 10, 15 degrees and enough so that if you touch metal, your skin will stick to it. Like, you know, when you stick your tongue out to a metal pole, you're flying often in a formation with other planes, often at night, you know, in 1930s and 40s technology, trying not to hit the guy next to you, dealing with flak, which is, you know, basically a shell that gets shot up into the air from the ground and explodes, spreading shrapnel everywhere. And the, you know, flak operators became very good at shooting a pattern so that your plane would be blanketed with this stuff. And it was essentially having bombs go off outside your plane. Again, imagine you're on that Continental 747 with the 22-year-old pilot hitting the turbulence in the thunderstorm, and now there are bombs going off outside your window. It's a little hairy right there, but that's even before the fighters find you. Now you have planes out there trying to knock you out of the sky, and they can move a hell of a lot better than you can. Bomber Command, by war's end, would lose 70,000 plus people. The American Army Air Corps will lose more than 80,000 in the whole war, but that number includes fighters, too. Bomber Command's numbers don't. That's a lot of people to lose. But as the heads of Bomber Command and the American Army Air Corps as well would point out, veterans of World War I that they were, that's one decent-sized World War I battle that could be over in a month. 70,000 people? That's the Somme, you know? I mean, those are not enormous casualties by what you'd become accustomed to in the 1914-1918 war, which so much of doctrine on the land, sea, and air was devoted to making sure never happened again, right? No more World War I's. Bomber Command's casualties for 6 years of war is one decent-sized Western Front battle. That gives you a perspective. And that's how it was looked at, too. This was supposed to be, at the time, a good use of lives. If you're going to lose people in a war, you want to measure the cost by the effectiveness. In the First World War, they were sending people up over the trenches to march into machine gun fire, losing tens of thousands of people in, you know, a single individual battle for nothing. You got nothing for those lives. If you're going to lose a certain number of people in a war, achieve something. The idea with both Bomber Command and the U.S. Army Air Corps, which it was known as at the time, is that for 80,000 lives or 70,000 lives, you got a whole lot of effectiveness. Those were lives well spent in a military sense. Now, effectiveness is one of those things we didn't get a chance to deal with in the show either, but it's a hugely controversial question. You did all this strategic bombing, all this damage, all these deaths on, you know, both sides. Was it worth it? What did it achieve? And what has to be recalled in this whole thing, and we tried to make a point of this in the podcast, was how much of this is uncharted territory when the Second World War starts. How the First World War, by the very end, just gives you the tiniest little appetizer-like taste of the potential of these things. When the war starts, nobody's really built the right kinds of air forces to do what they will eventually want to do by war's end. And so by 1945, the end of the war, you finally have these really fully articulated weapons. The later war British Strategic Bombing Force and American Strategic Bombing Forces, that's what guys like Julio DeWitt were envisioning. That's a fully formed air force by 1945 that can carry the war to the enemy and do great damage. And the damage that it did was really the beginnings of the metric, so you could see how all this worked. You want some real-world data on strategic bombing when you really have the tools to do the job? 1943, 44, 45 is when you get it. Those people are the first version of this. If we'd had a nuclear war, say, over the Cuban Missile Crisis, we would have gotten to see the new and improved version of it. The sheer fact that people didn't realize what this was going to get you or not get you made it a logical thing to try in total war. There's a lot of logical sense that goes into the idea that if you can wipe enemy cities off the map, that's going to help shorten the war or help convince the enemy that this war is not a good thing to continue doing. It makes logical sense. Once again, like the theme in the Logical Insanity show, though, when you start talking about the idea that wiping cities and their people that live in them off the map as being a good idea, you know, when we're out of the Mars-induced crisis of the moment, you know, in total war, we look at it and say, couldn't there have been a better way? Was all of this really necessary? That's part of the dichotomy between war and peace that, you know, makes it tough for people who were in conflicts and had to do things. You know, makes it tough for them to try to explain it to people who've never been in that kind of a situation. When I was growing up and learning history, I'm starting to say that a lot now. As I get older, I apologize, everybody. But I had always been taught that strategic bombing, once all the evidence was in, and just so you know, once we started capturing officials from the German government, you know, as the war was winding down, the first thing we, the Americans, did especially is throw them in a room and interrogate them, especially the people who were the Air Force types. They wanted to know how well all this stuff had worked. Now, this involves a whole other area we didn't get into in the earlier show, which is the inter-service rivalries, which, believe it or not, plays a bigger role in this than you would think. There were a lot of people in the Air Force branch of the Army in the United States that were very concerned about their branch. You see this in every major military in the world still today, the inter-service rivalries. Every now and then someone will come up with the idea of consolidation to save money and increase efficiency, and they'll say, we need a Navy and an Air Force and an Army. They're all really just one service that works together. And you will see the people in all three of those branches just freak out about this. Everyone's going to protect their institutional turf. And there was actually a lot of this concern in the Second World War, especially among the air power boys, because they were sort of the stepbrother of the other branches. Army and Navy are well established. You got this new branch. It's sort of attached to the Army because we still don't know what to do with it. This was part of proving that you were worth having and that people deserved respect in the Air Corps and that maybe the Air Corps should be totally independent and be its own, like Julio Duet would say, an independent service, not attached to the Army. The Air Force guys get these guys like Albert Speer, the man who was responsible for what's considered to be a production miracle in late Nazi Germany, and throw him into a room and start saying, okay, how much did the bombing affect you? That bombing we did in Schweinfurt at the ball bearing plant, how much did that, you know, cut your production? And they were getting data. Much of the stuff you'll go read from Richard Overy's got a new book, and the name escapes me now, but it's about the interrogations of these figures as they came in. And a lot of them are entitled, you know, U.S. Army Air Corps interrogations. They wanted to know how the bombing worked. And for a long time, you know, when I was a younger man, the whole idea was that it had been proven in the war, finally. The data had come in, and all this damage and all these lives lost on the ground and in the air with the pilots and the bombers and the civilians and everybody else didn't achieve much at all. From memory, I'm thinking it was like a 4% drop in production or something was the typical number thrown out. And this was kind of taken as standard for a very long time. Len Dayton, who was one of the people I used as a source for this program, was writing in 1992, and he repeated the same thing. You know, the same line that strategic bombing didn't achieve much. Now, I have to say, before I go into the new historians, I guess I could kind of see that when it came to Europe. I mean, if you tell me that's the fact, I'll go, okay, well, wow, that's surprising. But when you're talking about Japan, I couldn't ever process that correctly, because when you see the pictures of these Japanese firebombed cities, some of them are just gone. They look like a moonscape. You can't tell me that that doesn't affect production. I mean, there's no place for the workers to live anymore. I mean, you might say, well, it was still remarkably good, but you can't tell me 4%, 6%. I'm not believing those numbers. It just never made sense to me. Well, you have a whole new era now of historians, and of course the Second World War being what it is, it's receiving a lot of attention. People throwing out tons of new information, all kinds of different angles that were never part of the earlier histories. There's a lot of economic historians writing now, too, who look at this with a much more of, let's say, an accountant's eye for the numbers, right? You got Neil Ferguson writing, you got Adam Tooze writing, you got a lot of these people who come forward and say, no. Look at these numbers. They clearly show, that the strategic bombing was creating havoc. I mean, one of the angles that they use all the time that the earlier people just, I mean, these are basic things, but were just missed was the question of the opportunity costs. When you realize how many of these giant anti-aircraft guns the Germans were required to ring around their cities to try to deal with all the bombers that were coming forward, Albert Speer, in the interrogations I mentioned to you earlier, said very plainly, you know, if you go back and read it, it's interesting because he says it was all very effective against German production, because he says, do you know what the difference all of those flak guns, which were the famous 88s and some 128s, you know, the famous gun that just cut through tank armor. He said, do you know what all of those flak guns on the Eastern Front would have meant for our soldiers fighting there if we didn't have to put them around our cities to defend them from your bombers? So right there, guys like Neil Ferguson are saying, don't ignore the opportunity cost there. 70,000, a little more than 70,000 bomber command deaths essentially forced Germany to respond to that threat in a way that, you know, that saved that many lives somewhere else in another theater. So the opportunity cost of war. The other thing I found interesting was the way Spears' numbers had been misinterpreted. You know, in the interrogations, the Army Air Corps guy say to him, now, how were you able to get production of aircraft continually growing throughout the war? You know, in other words, making it look like the strategic bombing was having no effect on German production at all. Wow, we're bombing all these cities and blowing them off the map, and they're making more stuff. How is that happening? And Speer answered two ways. First, he said, you have to remember that the German economy had not been transferred to a war footing until mid-war. They didn't want to go on a war footing, thought they could fight a war without too many disruptions of the normal way of doing things, and didn't go on a war footing until mid-war. And that changed things, helped compensate for other losses in production. He also said that the numbers are deceiving. He said one bomber plane cost as much in terms of time, resources, energy, maintenance, and all that as four fighter planes. So you can make four fighter planes for every bomber plane. He goes, by the mid to the end of the war, we're not making very many bombers at all compared to the old days. So those numbers reflect the fact that our resources are being put more into fighters. We're still making less planes, though, than we would have made had you not been bombing and we'd had the economic situation we had, you know, in 1938, 39, and 40. In other words, once these economic writers started delving into the material, it becomes apparent that all of a sudden strategic bombing was doing more than we'd ever been taught as kids. And the truth of the matter is by the time you get to the atomic bomb, you do start to see like a Giulio DeWitt kind of theory finally coming to fruition. The idea that if you had 50 atomic bombs in your arsenal, you could literally just bring a country to heel by saying, okay, every day of this week we're going to bomb one of your cities, and every day of next week we're going to bomb, and we'll just reduce them one at a time until you give up. Of course, that's if only one side has the atomic or nuclear bomb. DeWitt doesn't talk too much in his work about the idea of what happens when, you know, you get to a Cold War situation and both sides have those kind of weapons. If you're the United States and you say to the Soviet Union, time to knuckle down or Moscow goes down tomorrow and it's Kiev the day after that, they say to you, fine, you get Moscow, we'll get D.C., you get Kiev, we'll get New York. See how that goes. What makes me kind of snicker about that whole thing is that that's just exactly what the whole idea of needing to have a whole strategic bombing force before the Second World War was based on. Need to have a strategic bombing force, not so that we use it on people, but so that we prevent them from using theirs. We essentially checkmate their strategic bomber threat by having the capability ourselves. You use yours on ours, we'll use ours on you, so why not just avoid that side of the conflict? It was the pre-atomic age version of mutually assured destruction. There's an interesting side, though, to the atomic bombs that had not been discussed very much until recent historians started getting back to the subject of the atomic bomb and, you know, what if the bomb hadn't been dropped and an invasion had had to take place and all this. And it turns out that it might have been the potential to use the bomb in a tactical, you know, battlefield way that might have had more of an influence, if you believe some of these people, than the idea that more cities might be destroyed. And Tokyo was definitely on the list. And don't think both sides didn't know it. The Japanese had to assume that the Americans had more bombs like these and that they would not spare the capital forever. In American circles, the talk was about perhaps getting the next atomic bomb, you know, ready to go, because these things weren't exactly stockpiled, but there was a production rate they could rely on. And when the next one came out, there were people already talking about dropping it on the capital city. But the Japanese apparently had a very detailed plan for fighting off an American land invasion. I told you these extra shows would be a good place to get into the military stuff a little bit more. And we didn't really touch much of this subject in the main show, because this is the sort of subject you talk about when you get into the standard debate on whether or not the bomb should have been used. You get into this question of things like, well, it would have cost a bazillion American lives to invade, and how much, you know, are those bombs worth, and all this kind of stuff. I do want to say, before we get into it, though, that this is a topic that's become so specialized, it reminds me a lot about talking about the John F. Kennedy assassination. They have so many people that have delved into this stuff so long that authors can make good money writing books that are geared simply towards the audience of experts, you know, amateur experts, who are called the buffs. And you can get John F. Kennedy assassination books that will make no sense to you at all unless you already know a lot about the John F. Kennedy assassination situation. The atomic bomb one is similar, and there are books, the good books that you could get right now will make no logical sense in terms of being fun or easy to read or giving you context. It's written more to take a pro or con side in this long-running argument about the atomic bomb and the morality of dropping it. Did we need to? Didn't we need to? Almost all of them have a point of view they're pushing. They're not unbiased. But that doesn't make the stuff they find, you know, useless or fabricated. A recent work called Hell to Pay, which is about the invasion of Japan and the cost and all this stuff. It really is just one of these atomic bomb books where it tries to show you the latest evidence, stuff taken from Japanese archives. It's really, if anything, overly comprehensive. Not a fun read, but very... What it makes you aware for sure is that the Japanese were preparing for an invasion by the United States. They actually had a very good idea of where it would happen already. They'd been stockpiling it. They'd been moving their best units from the Kwantung Army, which was located on the mainland and had never, you know, in the wars with China and against the border with Russia, and had not been involved in combat for a very long time. They were considered the prime forces of the Japanese Army. And there was a feeling amongst some of the militarists that, you know, looking at how many casualties the Japanese with their less than, you know, prime troops sometimes fighting on these islands could inflict on American forces, you know, in admittedly suicidal defenses. There was a loathe on the part of some of these Japanese army commanders especially to surrender before they had played that last card. They really thought it might turn out to be a wild card. And there was a real feeling in the Japanese command amongst some of the hierarchy there that the Americans didn't want to put up with the level of casualties that they, the Japanese command, felt like they might be able to inflict. They didn't have any more hopes of winning the war. In fact, one wonders what the Japanese hopes were at any stage in the war. I mean, when they launched the war, what was their best-case scenario for an outcome? That's always bedeviled me a little bit. But reading the material, it becomes plain that when you start talking about the Japanese, in quotation marks, at this stage in the war, we're not really talking about any single unified effort. The country is now run by a military cabal that has a sort of first among equal that keeps changing. Elements of the government seem to be completely divided on their stance on ending the war, not ending the war, having negotiations, not having negotiations. You'll often hear people say, well, peace feelers were already being put out by this or that. Yeah, but by this or that group doesn't mean the government has decided and that this is our course of action. There were actually people being killed and assassinated because they were advocating, you know, things like peace, for example. So it's difficult to divine Japanese intentions. The emperor was sort of your trump card if you were playing one side of the fence or the other, if you were part of the peace faction or the hawk faction. having the emperor in your camp sort of could generally tilt the decision one way or the other. In the book Hell to Pay, the author D.M. Giangreco, again, not unbiased, but points out very conclusively that the Japanese were very capable of inflicting lots of casualties on an invading force and fully intended to make use of the civilian population to do it. The numbers of Japanese that were going to die in these invasions is rarely taken into account. You know, we asked a question in the show about how many of your own soldiers should you be willing to lose to protect enemy civilians. It's one of those key questions, right, when you get into this whole thing. I mean, if you, should you lose one of your guys to save 10 of the enemy's women and children? I mean, it's sort of a foundational question. And that's how we often portray the morality of the A-bomb attack. You know, how many of our soldiers should we have sacrificed, you know, rather than drop those bombs? But think about all of the Japanese people that were going to die if this invasion happened. Because that's not something that troubled the high command. You can read some of the quotes and the things that they were saying. They weren't worried about, I mean, to them, they had 100 million people, and they saw it as unbelievable to think that the Americans could ever transport a force strong enough to defeat 100 million people. Sort of the idea Churchill had, if the Nazis and their armies landed and tried to take London, London had 7-8 million people in it. And what was the Churchill line? You can always take one with you. Wasn't Churchill's line. I think it was like a public ad campaign. You know, the Germans may be coming, but you can always take one with you. You know, meaning if you're going to die. Well, the Japanese had a very similar propaganda idea working too. There's 100 million of us, and you're never going to get 100 million of them across this distance. What may have, if you believe some of these newer historians, Giangreco says this too, I think, what may have actually changed some of the, you know, tilted the balance so that the peace faction in the Japanese government finally, you know, got a hold of things, might have been the fact that these atomic bombs could be used tactically. This is, by the way, something that has always fascinated military planners ever since. The idea of the tactical nuclear weapon, the battlefield nuke, put it in an artillery shell and use it to clear defenses. Use it against massed armies, you know, that are waiting behind a mountain range or something, you know, to do you harm. You have a whole bunch of the enemy in, you know, pillboxes and trenches and defenses in front of you. No problem. Use a battlefield nuclear weapon and all of a sudden that area is cleared. Well, the 1946 offensives against the Japanese home islands are envisioning the use of atomic bombs for just those purposes. The Japanese military planners are setting up these defenses and counting on them to inflict lots of casualties on the Americans. Okinawa and Iwo Jima have been huge shocks. The Americans had kind of contented themselves on this idea that the Japanese were not really that dangerous, you know, in combat, that their army wasn't really up to date, that their tactics and doctrine and, you know, armor, all that stuff really wasn't that dangerous. But in the kind of battles the Japanese were fighting, they could sure inflict a lot of death and destruction, especially since they were fanatical about disregarding their own safety in order to do so. And you have to think of them, if you want to understand the way they were seen by outsiders and even themselves, you have to think of the way there's a, you know, we think of the Islamic terrorists, no offense, Japanese people, but, you know, as being willing and almost eager to die for the cause. And that makes them extra dangerous, makes them extra difficult to deal with. They may not have the tactics, doctrine, and the armament and the, you know, the German army units brought to bear, but they have this fanatical willingness to sacrifice themselves to achieve something that might seem little. I mean, the Japanese soldiers would take satchel charges and run under tanks and blow themselves up. If you are the enemy commander, that is a heck of a weapon to have in your hand. And a lot of Japan's defense was going to be built on the willingness of their people, whether in planes or other situations, to sacrifice their own life to take out Americans. The idea and the understanding on both sides that these nuclear weapons could literally, you know, clear the battlefield areas before U.S. troops had to deal with any of these defenses, all of a sudden denied the Japanese high command, or this is the theory postulated in these books, denied the Japanese high command its wonderful heroic battle that they'd been planning. You know, they had a few tricks up their sleeve, too. They had 12 or 15 army divisions of the best quality moved over from the mainland, all these things were made moot. Now, We could just sit back if we wanted to as the United States and keep bombing them with atomic bombs strategically, or decide we wanted to invade and just sweep the battlefield, you know, the day before with atomic weapons. Remember, it wasn't until the late 1950s that we realized that it wouldn't be a good idea to send our troops through a recently atomized area for their own safety. There was a lot of post-World War II testing where you can see the films and the atomic bombs go off and our troops are in little slit trenches, and then 5 minutes later or something, they're told to stand up and walk toward the mushroom cloud. That was what they were thinking was going to happen in the invasion of the Japanese home islands, according to people like Gian Greco. We were going to ring the strategic plain near Tokyo, as I recall, with six of the atomic bombs, and they were going to be spaced out so that, you know, they basically just atomized around the entire landing area. I mean, this was going to destroy the whole Japanese plan to inflict enough casualties on American and British and other invaders to get them to think twice about things like unconditional surrender. Now, I want to stress, that's not everyone's theory. And Gian Greco's writing for, like, the Naval Press or something, so he's hardly unbiased. But we're not going to get into the arcane arguments of the A-bomb specialists on either side. It just becomes arguments over this piece of source material or that quote taken out of context, what have you. The point of the story is that the Japanese high command plainly intended to use up its citizens' lives to help convince the Americans that they shouldn't fight this war, that it was time to come to some sort of deal, and the number of Japanese civilians that would likely have been killed is appalling. And when you read the statistics, there's no way getting around the idea that it was going to be akin, our leaders actually believe worse because of the fanaticism of the Japanese, akin to going in and having to take Germany. And don't forget, the people that took the lion's share of cannon fodder job when it came to sucking up German bullets to make that whole thing possible was the Red Army. You can't use Western Allied casualty rates from the defeat of Germany as an example of how many it would take to defeat Japan, because the Soviets sucked up so much of that percentage. In Japan, those cannon fodder people would be Americans, and they were estimating that 10 to 15 million Japanese civilians would one way or another die in the defense of Japan. This is the part where the logical insanity idea from the earlier show gets brought back into the equation, where you could start, you know, it gets to where those air leaders like Spatz and everything were saying that the bomber is the savior of civilization. You know, when used properly, it's the most humane weapon of all. When you say, listen, yeah, we destroyed Hiroshima, and we destroyed Nagasaki, and we killed 160,000 people doing it, and saved 10 to 15 million Japanese civilian lives. Now you think about those pilots that some people, you know, thought I was accusing of war crimes, mistakenly. I apologize for that misperception. But now you think about those pilots in a very different light. Those people are inflicting civilian casualties. They know it. At the same time, you can make that same argument. If their efforts, if their bombs on civilians and military targets end up preventing the need for an invasion of Japan, they will save 10 to 15 million of the countrymen, of the very people, you know, that their bombs are killing below. It's the mental gymnastics that it forces, the total war forces on the morality of human beings, put you in a position where you just throw up your hands and realize that the chance of opting out of this dynamic, if you lived during that era, would have been almost nil. People did not have the free will to throw up their hands and say, you know what, I'm not going to be a bomber pilot. I don't want to kill anybody on the ground. I don't care how many people it might save theoretically. I won't do it. No country was willing to put up with that. Now, some might have said, well, we're not going to put you there. I don't want you in a sensitive position with that kind of attitude. But you couldn't opt out of what was going on. I remember saying during the Ostfront show that there were no conscientious objectors in Germany. And I meant that to be saying essentially that you weren't allowed to opt out of, you know, the German wars of conquest during the Second World War. It wasn't optional, right? If you were one of those Germans that said, I don't like war, I don't want to do it, I'm a poet, doesn't matter, you're going to the Eastern Front like everyone else, right? I got letters from people in Germany talking about Jehovah's Witnesses and other religious groups that actually did have conscientious objectors and who got in terrible personal danger and suffered all kinds of things because of it. So, sorry, don't want to exclude those people. My point was, is even in the Allied countries, this wasn't something where you got to sit down and weigh the moral rights and wrongs and consider, and I'm not very comfortable with this. It didn't work that way, especially in these countries where literally we were talking about existence. When the British are fighting the Germans in 1940, it's not a question of a couple colonies maybe shifting if the British lose. This is an existential threat. That's something Americans have very little understanding of. And it puts total war in a completely different light. Believe me, ask the Germans what it was like in 1945, existential threat. Ask the Russians what it was like in 1941-42, same thing. Ask the Japanese what it was like in 1945, and 1946 looked really bad. If you could look into the future and you're a Japanese person living in Japan in summer of 1945, the next year promises to be horrifying. Let me ask you a question. This is the turning of the A-bomb question on its head. If you could have gotten a Japanese person to speak freely, what do you think their opinion of the dropping of the atomic bomb, if they didn't happen to know anybody in Hiroshima or Nagasaki, was if they thought it ended the war? I'm sure they thought it was horrible, as anybody would, but at the same time, one wonders if they didn't breathe a sigh of relief. They knew they weren't going to win the war, probably, just making an assumption there. When your firebomb cities are everywhere smoldering, kind of gives you a hint. If you're going to lose the war anyway, would you rather lose it after two atomic bombs are dropped, or would you rather lose it after 10? Would you rather have another 6 months of firebombing before the end happened, or might as well have it happen now? One wonders if everyone didn't just sort of exhale when the Second World War ended and not ask too many questions about what it took to get you there. Now that I think about it, it's actually probably a bit presumptuous and pointless to try to get into the minds of a Japanese civilian, you know, after the atomic bombs were dropped. There were so many variables that a person like yours truly would be unable to figure out. I mean, how do you put yourself in the position of someone who's got these ancient codes connected to loyalty to emperor and all that kind of stuff? It's such a different mindset. It would be not fair, I guess, of me to assume anything. Hard to figure out what the average Japanese person was feeling. Not so hard to figure out. You don't even have to be particularly historically sensitive to figure out how the Allied planners, especially the American high command, was feeling about the war ending. You can literally almost feel the relief that they had then now. Think about what they had been tasked with. They'd been tasked with, I feel very comfortable calling it, the most difficult military operation of all time. And not just the most difficult by an amazingly long margin. And yet everyone seems to blithely assume it would have just gone fine. Oh, sort of the last little bit of the mopping up. Sure, it'll be brutal and bloody for a little while, but it'll end the war, it'll be the coup de grace, finish off the Japanese, over. I find that astounding. And all you have to do to realize how blithe a statement that is to think about how difficult we all understand D-Day to be. You know, the invasion of Normandy, right? The retaking of the continent from the Germans, the landings in France. We all know this, right? Largest amphibious operation ever, over less than 30 miles of water from a, let's be honest, enormous base right there, the British Isles. And it was such a near-run thing that Eisenhower wrote two letters the night before the invasion was launched. One announcing that the invasion was successful and, you know, giving the press some information on that. The other, which has come down to us in history, announcing the failure of the invasion and taking full responsibility for it and, you know, praising the dead and all that kind of stuff. Let's also remember that it was against a minor amount of opposition. The Germans did not have lots and lots of troops waiting on the other side of the channel for the Allies. There were some, but it wasn't like a full effort. The Germans were very occupied on their eastern front,
and they had spared what they could. Now, if that operation, if D-Day is considered something that's difficult because there's all these challenges, think about the Pacific. Think about what the U.S. was going to be doing here. They were going to not be crossing less than 30 miles of open ocean. They were going to be crossing thousands of miles of ocean. They didn't have some giant base right there on the other side of the channel. Their bases were small. They were islands, you know, chains of them going all the way back to Hawaii. Your real supply lines are stretching from the U.S. West Coast, thousands of miles away. Nothing like this has ever been attempted. Think about the equivalent, Americans. Think about some European power launching a naval-borne invasion all the way across the Atlantic, which is not as big as the Pacific, obviously, landing troops on the U.S. East Coast, and then maintaining their supply all the way back to Europe continually for months at least. All the bullets, all the artillery shells, all the replacement troops, all the food. Imagine some Asian power, you know, gobbling up a few islands in the Pacific all the way, then gobbling up Hawaii, and then attacking California, Oregon, and Washington. With enough people, first of all, to have a chance of success, but then with the continual supplies over thousands of miles of ocean for months at least. It is astounding when you consider the logistics involved. And yet, so many people I talk to automatically assume it's a done deal. When you read, especially the more modern stuff, but when you read the opinions of some of the Japanese hawks on what they expected or were looking to achieve, all they wanted to do was exacerbate what they already saw as a problem-filled invasion. That's a huge amount of stuff that the Americans and Allied command have to overcome before they even get involved with the first Japanese soldiers. The more you look at the impediments to actually invading Japan, the more you start to see that the Japanese hawks were kind of being logical. If they didn't have to worry about atomic bombs destroying all their defenses and wiping all that out, if you didn't take that into account, it seems pretty darn likely to me that they had a significant chance of being able to inflict enormous casualties on an American invasion force, enough so that the United States would, let's just say, pause and think. Now, pause and think about what, though, exactly? It's worth asking, you know, what sort of options existed for the American president and American generals and American and allied planners if things didn't go well in the invasion of the Japanese home islands? What if you're 3 months into the fighting, the casualty numbers are enormous, the Japanese show no signs of giving up, and the job ahead still looks huge? You know, you haven't even made that much progress in 3 months. What options do Allied planners have? Well, they can modify the surrender terms. This is one of the most interesting and controversial parts of the whole A-bomb question, which is actually bigger than just the A-bomb part of the story. It goes all the way back and influences all kinds of events in Europe, too. The question of unconditional surrender. It's a famous question, of course, in people who debate the end of the war. Unconditional surrender were the stated terms of the Allies and had been stated publicly as, you know, how the war could end from the middle of the war. Long before the war was decided, the Allies were saying publicly that the only surrender that was going to be accepted was one that was without any conditions at all, where the enemy puts themselves entirely in the power of the Allied nations. Now, unconditional surrender comes, when you say it, it comes with a cost right away. Everyone realizes that more people are going to die if you insist upon unconditional surrender on all sides than if you basically say you're willing to accept some sort of deal. Nations will surrender more quickly if they can get good terms. They will resist more stiffly if they can't, especially these nations where, you know, the leaders basically run the nations themselves. I mean, if Adolf Hitler knows he's going to be strung up by the Allies and he can't save his own skin, he's going to make the German people fight harder for him. If all of a sudden he thought he might be allowed to stay in power, well, let's start listening to what sort of offers we might have. That's a perfect example, too, of how difficult it would have been maybe until the U.S. suffered a bazillion casualties in a Japanese invasion, how difficult it would have been to make the case even to the American people that you were going to accept the Japanese emperor staying in power. This, by the way, was the only term that by the end of the war the Japanese were insisting upon. The emperor was a godlike figure, and they wanted the emperor's authority and power intact. Then they would be willing to surrender. The Americans have been criticized for saying, no, that's not going to be allowed, especially since, you know, when we finally did get unconditional surrender from the Japanese, we then let them have the emperor anyway. That always is a little hard to rationalize. But you have to understand that the Americans have been propagandized to think of the emperor in a very similar vein to the way we thought of other Axis leaders. We know now that the emperor did not have the total control over events that, say, fascist dictators had, that he was in some ways a puppet, in some ways a tool, but that wasn't either apparent or certainly wasn't sold to the American people at the time. He was demonized along with Hideki Tojo, the major figure who is often credited at the early parts of the war anyway with having that kind of control. It would have been to turn around and go to the American people and say, well, all right, we're going to allow the surrender of the Japanese and they get to keep their emperor, would have been very much like going to the Allies in 1944 and the populations of Europe and saying, we're going to end the war. We have a deal from the Germans. And remember, the last year of the war was the most bloody, the most horrible in every way. If the Germans had come in the summer of 1944, a year before they actually ended, and said to the Allies, we surrender, the only condition is Adolf Hitler and the Nazis have to stay in power. How tempting would that have been? How tempting would it have been even to the Soviets, who wanted nothing more than to smash fascism, if they knew how many lives were going to be lost in that last year for them? How tempting would it have been? And if you want to examine one place in this whole A-bomb story that's just weird, it's that unconditional surrender question. Why was this such a big deal to Franklin Delano Roosevelt? You know, was Churchill really shocked at that announcement where Roosevelt essentially said to the press, you know, that we would only accept unconditional surrender? I've read that Churchill was shocked and dismayed by that whole thing. If you go back and you look, you would think that there would be tons and tons of debate over what the proper war aim should be for a country. You know, what will we accept in terms of a deal? To say we will accept no deal in the middle of the war when things are not decided yet, you know, makes you wonder what was going on. And just so you know, Roosevelt can hide a little bit. There was a committee he established to decide what the surrender should be and all that. I mean, there's a little bit of window dressing, but it certainly doesn't look like enough to have justified a war aim that literally condemned, you know, untold millions of people, probably. You can't say with what-if scenarios, but probably condemned millions of people in total to death that wouldn't have died if some sort of deal could have been reached. Again, speculation, but normally that's the deal you look at. If you could have ended the war in 1944 somehow, or you could have ended either of the fronts, maybe you settled with the Japanese but not with the Germans, you would have saved a ton of people's lives. And this is what always gets to me when we get back to the atomic bomb question. People will say things like, well, you know, those people didn't need to die. And I told you at the beginning of the last show, the Logical Insanity show, that I don't think civilians should have been put in harm's way to begin with. I don't think that should have been a part of things. But what I think doesn't matter. In fact, one could philosophically ask the question, why the life of a 22-year-old soldier from your side, you know, the side that didn't start the war, why that person's life is inherently any less valuable than a 70-year-old man from the enemy's civilian camp, or a 6-year-old boy, or a woman of any age? There are certain modern and not so modern sensibilities that have established that it's okay for fighting men to lose their lives and that that's to be expected, but that you cross a line when you start killing people who are not part of the fighting crew. Now, I tend to think that way myself, but that doesn't make it right from a philosophical point of view. It's a very debatable point. As I said, how many of your soldiers' lives are the enemy civilians worth? Different people are going to come to different conclusions. I'm not sure Roosevelt could have gone to the American people in the, you know, situation at hand and the climate that had existed, and at least before the U.S. had suffered a lot of casualties, say to the American people, we're going to accept an unconditional surrender and leave the emperor in, as I said. So people today will look back and say, well, those people shouldn't have had to die in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. My answer to that, though, is you're simply isolating those two areas. People are dying every day, tens of thousands every month, most of them Japanese. The firebombings are going on all the time. As we said in the last show, the last firebombing happened after the second atomic bomb was dropped. If you didn't drop those atomic bombs, the U.S. Air Force was going to continue to burn down Japanese cities. We weren't just going to pull back and just stop everything. If you save the people of Hiroshima and Nagasaki from those atomic bombs, who's to say they don't get firebombed the week after that and suffer similar levels of casualties? How is that any better? Some people point out that, you know, a blockade could have been established and we sort of could have starved the Japanese into surrender. But let's remember that 800,000 German civilians were dead at the end of the First World War from the starvation blockade that had been imposed on them. And had the war continued another year, which it easily could have if Germany had been given an unconditional surrender option, they negotiated a deal and that allowed them to, you know, save their people from having enemy armies traipsing around the countryside in their country. That deal, though, that ended the First World War is part of what supposedly goes into the mindset of these people who felt, you know, like Roosevelt did, that you had to have unfettered ability to remake these societies, these militarist societies, as he saw them. Got to be able to go and root out the militarists in all these countries. And to do that, you have to demand, you know, that they surrender unconditionally, that they are utterly crushed, and then you can be a merciful victor after that. There's actually a whole article that was published in Military History Quarterly from a historian called The Tragedy of Unconditional Surrender, where he talked about Roosevelt's actual motivations and where he got this idea that it was a good idea. And it goes back to Ulysses S. Grant and the Civil War and all this kind of stuff. The point is that people have wondered for a long time why this was so important to Roosevelt. Was it just a political statement for the press? Was it something he said without really considering it much and then all of a sudden had to stand by it? Or was it something where Roosevelt looked back to the First World War, as some historians have suggested, saw that the problem there was that we didn't go into those societies and remake them, that we allowed them the cover to claim that they'd never really lost on the battlefield, that they were stabbed in the back, and this time be able to settle it for good so that the next generation of people in Western Europe and the United States and Eastern Europe didn't have to go in and root out German or Japanese militarists again. And while I have all sorts of qualms about this or that from a moral standpoint in the Second World War, I mean, just look at what the Germans did. I mean, like that one guy said that we quoted in the Logical Insanity show, you know, he's standing at the still smoking crematoriums, you know, of some of these death camps. And he says, this puts to rest all qualms about strategic bombing when you see this. It's hard to argue that Roosevelt, if he really was thinking that rooting out these societies, militarist from the core, was the, you know, secret to not having it happen again, one is tempted to look at the results and say that the transformation from a militarist standpoint that we see in Japan since the end of the Second World War and Germany since the end of the Second World War is nothing short of miraculous. Look at the history of both of those peoples and you see militarism, both in a good and bad sense, woven throughout those societies. Since the end of the Second World War, it's hard to think of two more peaceful, large, populous nations than Germany and Japan. If you want to get back to that logical insanity point, it's interesting to think about how all that terrible stuff that both sides did in the Second World War, how that may have, if it really played out the way Roosevelt thought, preventing another European war. Think about how many millions of lives then that might have saved. Especially since if you'd had a World War III involving, you know, the old powers of Europe, Germany fighting in World War III, everybody would have had nukes. I mean, that's a huge what if. It's a flight of fancy. But you have to consider that if things had stayed the way that they had been, you know, up until 1946, that would have been as likely as not. Now, there are a couple other reasons that are often cited as important in why the atomic bomb was dropped. And I thought I would just at least deal with them quickly. One is racism. You'll hear that sometimes. And the idea
basically stems from the thought that because the Japanese weren't white, a bomb was used on them that would not have been used on people who were. The reason I don't give a lot of time to these arguments is because the bomb was designed to be used principally with Germany in mind. And look what we were doing to German cities already. I mean, as we said in the whole show, if you're willing to bomb Hamburg and Dresden and all these places to the degree that we were, there would have been no reason to say, hey, we'll do that to white people, but we won't drop an atomic bomb on Caucasians. Doesn't make any sense to me. I think the logical insanity of the time shows you that we were going to drop an atomic bomb on anyone we had to drop an atomic bomb on to end the war, because we certainly weren't pulling our punches with the Air Force we had at the time. As we've said over and over, if you're willing to firebomb enemy cities, you're willing to do anything to them. So the racism thing never played much with me, although there's no question there was racism in the war, and racism as a propaganda tool, and, everybody used that practically, stereotyping the enemy. But I don't think that led to a different treatment on the battlefield. I think it was really a case of kill or be killed in the Pacific War. And I think that's the way both sides saw it. The other idea that's often thrown out there is that the atomic bomb was dropped to send a message to the Soviets. In other words, yes, Japan was done, and these didn't need to be used on Japan, but we wanted to demonstrate the power of this new weapon to intimidate, what we could already see was going to be a difficult post-war relationship with the communist Soviet Union, right? Show Joseph Stalin what we can do. The problem I've always had with this idea is that if you really consider this to be an important reason to use the bomb, and when you talk about people who think that was, they consider it to be the reason it was used. But if that's the case, why do you offer the Japanese the chance to surrender before you use them? I mean, if you really want to make sure that this weapon you spent so much time and effort developing gets tested in a real-world situation so you can go take pictures and everyone, can have their intelligence service realize, wow, don't mess with the United States. Did you see what Hiroshima looked like after that bomb hit it? Then why give the Japanese a chance to, put the kibosh on that? And if you're really going to be, and listen, there's real-world reasons that this might have been the case, right? That's why people have the theory. But it doesn't make any sense to me then to allow the Japanese to call off this important test to intimidate the Soviets. You drop the bomb, and then you offer peace terms, if that's what you feel is so important. So again, to me, I never saw the logic behind this idea. I think there was certainly the side benefit of intimidating the Soviets. And I think you hear Truman say that sometimes where, won't the Soviets get a kick out of this kind of thing? But that wasn't the prime motivation. It was just a side benefit, I think you could say. Finally, the question of why the second bomb is dropped at all, I think is intriguing. And some people like to point out that the two bombs were of different construction. One was a uranium bomb, the other a plutonium bomb. And so the people that like the theory that this was all testing and we were using Japanese cities as sort of a testing ground like to point out that you had to use both bombs so you could see the difference between what a uranium one did and what a plutonium one did. I don't think that theory is that valid only because you don't need a city to do that. It is the second bombing is a little puzzling until you realize that they were going to firebomb anyway. I mean, if you never drop the bomb, as we said, on Nagasaki, Nagasaki's going to get firebombed because we firebombed people after we dropped the second bomb. So, again, once you realize that we're destroying these cities anyway, you start to say to yourself, okay, was there something extra bad about using the plutonium bomb on Nagasaki? Would it have been better to firebomb it? Would less people have died? Would more people have died? You see how difficult it is to start having a moral argument when you're on a foundation of sand, and that's what these wartime situations present you with. I tend to look at the dropping of the atomic bombs in a similar way to when you see somebody who's afflicted with a fatal disease and has to go through a terrible, painful process before they die. How, as you watch that, you begin to see this thing that you so much dreaded, death, as a better option than what the patient's currently living through. You begin to see death as merciful. You begin to see it as an end of suffering. If you look at the casualty numbers
and you see what, especially the Japanese, I mean, again, we talk about the Allied side all the time and saving Allied lives, and rightly so. But even from a Japanese perspective, if you look at the casualties every month, they are horrific. And it's calculated, you know, on a schedule, just like First World War casualties. Every day the war continues, more Japanese soldiers and civilians are going to die. That's like suffering through the terrible rigors of cancer and the pain and the suffering and the stuff that's even intended to save your life, the chemotherapy. If those atomic bombs were the exclamation point, the horrible exclamation point that stopped the suffering, you begin to see that as merciful. Especially when you realize that all the other stuff that was happening at the same time, the firebombings, the daily, I mean, and what the invasion was going to do to the Japanese, you begin to see that anything that stopped the war and didn't produce, you know, genocidal casualties doing it was better than what most people thought was going to happen. As I said, my stepfather and a lot of other people's relatives on both sides were preparing to die in what was coming up. They were sure of it. And so many of these people were sure of it. You know what it reminds me of? There was a fantastic letter at the end of Hell to Pay that the author, as I said, not unbiased, published by, written by James Michener, the author who often wrote about, you know, Second World War stuff and whatnot. And Michener wouldn't allow this letter to be released until after he died. But he was writing to somebody to explain his reticence at speaking at a get-together, a rally, something like that, a protest, whatever it was, that was denouncing the dropping of the atomic bombs. And when Michener released this letter, it was intended after his death to explain, you know, why he'd never been able to go to those kind of, you know, anti-A-bomb rallies and speak. And here's, I'm going to quote the letter in its entirety. It sums up what my stepfather was feeling and what a ton of these other veterans, and many of you know, I heard from many of you after the show, what a lot of these people were feeling. And remember, the Japanese soldiers who knew they were going to be on the other side of this must have been feeling similar things, even if they probably didn't articulate them openly. The person he's writing to, his name is Martin. The letter starts, quote, "Dear Martin, in the summer of 1945, I was stationed on Espiritu Santo, close to a big army field hospital manned by a complete stateside hospital staff from Nebraska and Colorado. I had close relations with the doctors, so I was privy to their thinking about the forthcoming invasion of Japan. They had been alerted to prepare for moving onto the beaches of Kyushu when we invaded there, and they were prepared to expect vast numbers of casualties when the Japanese home front defense forces started their suicide attacks. More important," he writes, "I was on my own, very close to an army division that was stationed temporarily in a swampy wooded section on our island. They were a disheartened unit, for the Japanese had knocked them about a bit in the action on Saipan. Their assignment to our swamp was a kind of punishment for their ineffective conduct on Saipan. Now they were informed unofficially that they would be among the first units to hit the beach in our invasion of Kyushu, and they were terrified. In long talks with me, they said that they expected 70 or 80% casualties, and they could think of no way of avoiding the impending disaster. So," he writes, "it was with knowledge of what the doctors anticipated and what the army men felt was inescapable that I approached the days of early August, and I too became a bit shaky because the rumor was that I might be attached to the army unit because of my expertise in keeping airplanes properly fitted in the sky. Then came the astounding news that a bomb of a new type had been dropped on Hiroshima, a second one on Nagasaki, and that the Japanese emperor himself had called upon his people to surrender peacefully and await the Allied peacekeeping forces to land and establish the changes required by the recent turn of events. How did we react? With a gigantic sigh of relief. Not exultation because of our victory, but a deep, gut-wrenching sigh of deliverance. We had stared into the mouth of Armageddon, and suddenly the confrontation was no longer necessary. We had escaped those deadly beaches of Kyushu. I cannot recall who was the more relieved," he writes. "The doctors who could foresee the wounded and the dying, or the GI grunts who would have had to have done the dying, or the men like me who had sensed the great tragedy that loomed. All I know is that we said prayers of deliverance and kept our mouths shut when the arguments began as to whether the bombs needed to be dropped or not. and I have maintained that silence to this moment, when I wanted to have the reactions of the men understood who had figured to be on the first waves in. Let's put it simply, he writes, never once in those first days, nor in the long reconsiderations later, could I possibly have criticized Truman for having dropped that first bomb. True, I see now that the second bomb on Nagasaki might have been redundant, and I would have been just as happy if it had not been dropped. And I can understand how some historians can argue that Japan might have surrendered without the Hiroshima bomb. But the evidence from many nations involved at that moment testify to the contrary. From my experience on Saipan and Okinawa, when I saw how violently the Japanese soldiers defended their caves to the death, I'm satisfied they would have done the same on Kyushu. Also, because I was in aviation and could study battle reports about the effectiveness of airplane bombing, especially with those super deadly firebombs that ate up the oxygen supply of a great city, I was well aware that the deaths from the firebombing of Tokyo in early 1945 far exceeded the deaths of Hiroshima. So I have been able to take refuge, he writes, in the terrible, time-tested truism that war is war, and if you're unlucky enough to become engaged in one, you better not lose it. The doctrine, cruel and thoughtless as it may sound, governs my thought, my evaluations, and my behavior. I could never publicly turn my back on that belief, so I've refused opportunities to testify against the United States in the Hiroshima matter. I know that if I went public with my views, I would be condemned and ridiculed. But I stood there on the lip of the pulsating volcano, and I know that I was terrified at what might happen and damned relieved when the invasion became unnecessary. I accept the military estimates that at least 1 million lives were saved, and mine could have been one of them. Sincerely, James Michener. End quote. And if you were one of those men worried about having to hit the beaches in Japan when the invasion of the home islands started, what sort of leaders would you want running the war effort? Would you want people that were worried about, you know, morality in any way, shape, or form? Or would you be hoping you had the most brutal killer of the snake type personality you could find? Another thing that messes with our heads when we look back in wartime situations from a peacetime vantage point is the attitude of these commanders, because they are relentless and ruthless. But those very qualities that look kind of rough to us and a little bit edgy and iffy to us now are the exact same qualities that make them a can-do person during the war. I mean, if you are about to, you know, start to be redeployed for the invasion of the home islands and you're with James Michener, and you've already been beaten up in Saipan, and you're looking at 70 to 80% casualty rates, don't you want an air commander who talks like this? This is Curtis LeMay speaking about morality in war. Quote, from the practical standpoint of the soldiers out in the field, it doesn't make any difference how you slay an enemy. Everybody worries about their own losses, but to worry about the morality of what we were doing? Nuts. A soldier has to fight. We fought. If we accomplish the job in any given battle without exterminating too many of our own folks, we consider that we'd had a pretty good day. End quote. Curtis LeMay, the air general in charge of the firebombing of Japan. The interesting part about that quote, though, is when LeMay says enemy, he includes the civilian population that he's firebombing. That's the key distinction. LeMay is only attacking the enemy, but the enemy happens to be every Japanese person living in Japan. That's the key difference that makes it difficult sometimes for us to look back on this from a peacetime situation. In peacetime, that's a distinction we make. In wartime, that's a distinction that can disappear very easily. Once that question of how many of your own troops do you lose to protect enemy civilians becomes something more than theoretical. And if you look at the, you know, post-Second World War careers of some of these architects of the bombing strategies, people like Curtis LeMay or Sir Arthur Bomber Harris in Britain, you can see the, you know, wartime gruffness that those people, you know, had served them so well during wartime work against them when the sensibilities switched to a peacetime mode. LeMay would become the hawkiest of the Cold War hawks. In the 1950s, he sets up the Strategic Air Command and all the infrastructure and foundation for that. The whole idea is to be able to wipe Soviet cities off the map if you need to. And what still seemed okay, you know, his wartime sort of talk and edginess in the 1950s became almost a caricature by the 1960s, and LeMay will be lampooned in movies like Dr. Strangelove and Failsafe as sort of a crazy, you know, apocalyptic wartime bomber. He'll end his career, unfortunately, ignominiously as the vice presidential running mate for third-party and pro-segregationist candidate George Wallace in the early 1970s. Sir Arthur Harris will not have anything quite that dramatic happen to him. He'll be treated more like he's invisible compared to the, you know, other war heroes from the other services. He's buried in a relatively unknown, out-of-the-way grave. They unveiled a statue of him. Margaret Thatcher did a while back, but there was almost no one there. And several authors I've read said, you know, he was booed by the few people who were. So it's sort of one of these things where we look back on what even the Allies had to do in order to win that war, and we're ashamed of some of it. Seems to me that that is a useless waste of emotion. Not only can you not change the past, you can't even get really into the mindset of the people who were fighting that war so that you could judge it from a perspective of, you know, the old line about, you know, a jury of your peers. Well, without being in that wartime survival existential mode, you can't be a member of their peers. They would have to be judged by somebody in a similar situation. Seems to me we would do a lot better to focus on the fact that even though we're uncomfortable with the rhetoric of a guy like Curtis LeMay, the actual true policy of not just our country, but several other countries, is to do exactly what he was going to use the American Strategic Air Force to do to the Soviet Union, should we need to. We don't like the way it sounds, but the policy of almost any nuclear-armed nation is to use their weapons, should their existence be threatened, on the other guy's cities. And it's the same rationale. Nobody says that's why they have it. That's just like why you had to have a bombing force in the Second World War. You have it to keep the other guy from using it. But if you're about to have your capital fall and your country be occupied by your most bitter enemy, when survival is at stake, you're going to want another Curtis LeMay. There's something both sad and understandable about that. It's a little like logical insanity, right?